We're talking about the need versus the number of airplanes and pilots, and it's kind of overwhelming, isn't it? How much need is out there?
The need is great. The statistics I hear are there are 3,000 unreached people groups, people living in little pockets of civilization up in the mountains where society has never gone, a civilization's never gone, who've never had anyone come to tell them anything. They don't know the basics of clean drinking water, much less the basics of the gospel of Jesus. So just huge, huge needs. And pilots are the ones that help them get there.
What parts of the world would these be in?
All parts of the world. Maybe not in the United States. Maybe there's some people in Idaho that don't have a radio.
Careful now. There might be some Idahans here. Idahoans. Steve, amplifying that for just a little bit, because we were talking about how important the role of an airplane is and what it means and how it affects lives. And yet, you must be constantly faced with decisions on resource decisions, essentially, who you can help, how much help you can give. And in the end, it must be a little bit frustrating.
Well, you know, until you've lived in a place where transportation, other than what you can do yourself on your own legs, doesn't exist, and you don't have access to medical care, you don't have access to education, you don't have access to news of what's happening in the rest of the world, you really can't appreciate what a machine with wings that can fly, you can use the air highway, how it can change your life. Now, I grew up in that world, and you know, we all societies have their hierarchy. Here, you know, professional people, doctors, and whatnot, we respect, but there's nobody in the world beyond roads, there is nobody that is at a higher status and more appreciated than the guy who sits in the front left seat in an airplane, because the doctor can't help you unless he can get to you, and he can't help you unless you can get to him. The pilot can bring him in, he can bring medicines, he can take you to the doctor, he can take you to the people that you care about and love, he can bring them to you. So the pilot really plays a very, very critical role, which gives the guy sitting in the plane a lot of influence. Now, there are a lot of North Americans who have been doing the things that we've been telling you about, but what excites me the most is teaching people who may not be able to read and write how to fly. And they want to do it. They want to be in the driver's seat. They want to be the ones delivering the medicine. They want to bring the sick people to their clinic and be able to take care of them. And as the Waurani, the tribe that killed my dad and that I grew up in relationship with, when I went down there to live with them in the mid-90s, they decided it was time for me to come back and live with them to teach them the things that I had learned in the outside world. And I said, well, like, what things do you want me to teach you? And they told me about the baga bia, the tooth thing. They said the people's teeth hurting. And then they told me about the daikau, the mosquito fever, malaria. And then they said, what we want you to do is, they said, when your father came going fast from place to place in the Ebo, the would-be, that's what they call the airplane, because a big jungle bee.
The would-be.
Yeah, it's a big jungle bee that sounds kind of like a small airplane when it's flying. They said, your dad going fast from place to place, that's how he came. And they said, and now you coming back, you too can go fast from place to place. And I was trying to figure out, where is this going? They said, now, you teaching us, we too will go fast from place to place, taking care of the people. And I was thinking, they want to go from the Stone Age to the Space Age in one jump. And I didn't think it could happen, but I'd made the mistake of saying, okay, you guys taught me what I needed to know so that I could live in this world, you know, how to make poison for my blowgun darts and how to put kapok on the poison and how to load it. And out our way, we've got a huge grocery store, but the meat department is wild. So you have to have something to bring the groceries home. And they had taught me those things, and they said, okay, now, just like we taught you when you were totally ignorant, now you teaching us to do the things that only the foreigners can do, we're going to do it ourselves. And flying was one of the first things.
Is this where you got the idea for the Maverick?
That's where the idea for
the Maverick. Have you all seen the Maverick? Clap if you've seen the Maverick. Or as the prototype name was the Missionary Assault Vehicle. Right?
I told you that in confidence.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I had never thought of that.
That was just between us, you know. Never tell a reporter anything in confidence, Steve, even though I'm unemployed. Okay, so tell us a little bit about this. Is the notion to take this flying dune buggy and give it to some of the indigenous people as a way so they can be the would-bes?
No, not give it to them, because if you give it to them, it won't last. But they want to own it. They want it to be theirs. That means it has to be dependable, it has to be simple to maintain, and it has to be affordable. So we're going to need to find a commercial market for it here in North America and Europe, so that we can make it in large enough numbers that it can be affordable. And I think we can do that. I think we can get it down in nonprofit uses and humanitarian uses, for missionaries and for the people that missionaries have been serving, so that they can do it, manage it on their own. I think we can get it down to the cost of a no-frills small pickup. But you guys are going to have to pay more for it to get it that cheap.
This is kind of the Kodiak model, right? You know, what every 10th airplane is earmarked for charity, essentially, or something like that.
We'd like it to be a little bit higher ratio than that, but we'll see.
Pete, do you have a favorite story? And do you honestly think you've saved lives, you and your group? Is there any doubt?
Without a doubt. I have it in writing. I've had it in phone calls. I've had it in people walking up to me and putting their arms around me in tears. You've saved the life of my son. How can I ever repay you? One of the stories that I will never forget as long as I live. It was Christmas afternoon, Eve afternoon, the day before Christmas, and Muskegon, Michigan called me. I had just started Wings of Mercy, and they heard about it. And a little girl that had a brain tumor that had to go to Mayo Clinic now. And I said, I'll do it. And picked this little girl up. She was about 5 years old, six. And Grandpa and Grandma were there, and they thought they would never see her alive again, and they were weeping. And Dad and Mom put them on the airplane. I said, hey, we have to go now. We must go. And the doctor had ordered that we couldn't fly above 6,000 feet because I had a Seneca 2, which is not pressurized, and we abided by that rule. We filed for 6,000 going west. And right over the Mississippi River, I get a tap on my shoulder that her temperature, they had a temperature probe in her, her temperature had gone up to 104, 105 or something. And they said, what do we do? No, you must make that decision. I said, we can land right here at La Crosse and get an ambulance, get her to the hospital right now, or we can keep going to Rochester. How long does that take? Oh, about 11 minutes, I said. And they determined we're going to go to Rochester. I contacted Minneapolis Center, which I was in contact with, and said we have an emergency. They contacted Rochester, and then I went to their frequency, and they said you can have any runway you wish. I selected 20, and I also asked them to get an ambulance to meet us on the runway. And we landed, and then the pilot or the tower said, just shut your engines off, stop right where you are. And they got this little girl in their care, and they had her on the life support system before I got the luggage out. they did it that fast. Well, the next day, it happens to be my wife's birthday on Christmas Day, and the next day, at about 10:30 in the morning, the phone rang. Father called, and they said, "We have witnessed a Christmas miracle." And they had taken this brain tumor out and saved the life of that precious little girl. And now, as time goes on, we have these fundraisers in Muskegon annually. She and her mother, over the years, have come. And this last year, now she's graduating from some college, I forget what it is, and she's going to get her master's degree, and she put her arms around me, and both she and her mother, and finally myself, were in tears.
Wow. You couldn't have got that fishing in Florida, could you? Not even close. That's amazing.
And I say one more thing, and that is about our pilots. I believe in my life experience, including my church, my choirs, the whole nine yards, nobody is like these pilots. They are the greatest group of givers I have ever experienced in my life. They will go from point A to point B and pick up these total strangers and take them to Baltimore or whatever it is. They're not allowed to get any gifts from them, and they would probably never see them again. And these guys give their airplanes, their time, their talent, and they're awesome.
That's fantastic. The you know, this might be a good time. You know, don't forget, we're going to take your questions in just a little bit. So if you have any, let us know. But anticipating some questions here, I'm sure a lot of people out there would like to know how they could help. And what are the requirements for Pete and Walt for your programs? What kind of airplanes and ratings and time, that sort of thing?
Well, I can say this. We have singles and twins, and pressurized twins, turboprops, and some jets. And we always fly with two pilots.
Oh, really?
Oh, so absolutely.
It's like 135 operation.
Absolutely. Yeah. The pilot in the right seat must be able to fly that airplane in instrument conditions in case the pilot in the left seat dies or gets sick. And that's a requirement. And we maintain that very strictly.
And your safety record has been good?
It's been perfect, and we thank the pilots, and we thank our God.
Yeah. All right. Walt, so instrument rating, two pilots. You're not too picky about the type of airplane?
No.
Okay.
No. Pilot in command has got to have a minimum of 600 hours and 100 hours of instrument time. And co-pilot's going to have 300 hours and 50 hours of instrument time.
And all your missions are instrument?
They're all are instruments.
Mm-hmm. All right, Walt, how about if somebody wanted to help out with your program? What are the rules?
High-performance aircraft, we don't require two pilots. We encourage two pilots. Our pilots aren't as old, so... We encourage two pilots, and they're required to file an instrument flight plan when they fly, so they need to be instrument proficient in current the airplane and meet the FARs. We let the FAA regulate the pilot qualifications, but we do require an instrument rating in a high-performance airplane.
What about if you really wanted to take the plunge and go fly in the jungle? Steve, I'll start with you, because Gracie's not a pilot. She was just very close to a pilot. What if you really wanted to do that and start, you know, doing good work in very remote places with airplanes, what would you do?
Well, what I did is I went to college and, you know, my dad died. I was a little boy. He was going to teach me how to fly, and that wish never came true. So when I went to college, I bought a J3 Cub for $2,200. And learned to fix and fly. And I begged and borrowed instruction from people till I got 10 hours, and a brother-in-law who is going to Central America as a missionary pilot signed me off and forgot to put restrictions in it. So I flew all over the Midwest in my J3 alone on weekends and sometimes not weekends while I was at college. And then I built up time from there. But when I went down, when the tribe asked me in the 90s to go back down to the jungles, I had flown in the jungles with other people, but I really didn't. No, we're talking really, really short, rough, muddy airstrips. But I had, on weekends, I would go out and take my J3 Cub, and food is really important in college. And I found out that when people were having picnics, if I just landed in the pasture on the road next to them, they would not only feed me, but they'd send food back for my friends at college, which I then would sell in the dorm to get gas so I could go back and do another picnic.
Wow, for a missionary, you're quite an entrepreneur. That's pretty good.
Now, the best one was I would take other college kids out who would find out I had an airplane, and they would want to go flying, and I would tell them, now you get scared, and they'd say no, and I'd say, okay, this is the deal. If you get scared, you grab those two bars in the windshield, and then I'll land, but you owe me $10. And on a Saturday, I could usually make about $50, $60, because they would all... about the time it goes into a spin... They're offering 20, 30.
You're giving missionary pilots a bad name, Steve.
So you're atoning for torturing people. Is that what you're doing?
No, the students would go back and recruit other students because they wanted to see how scared they would get. And if you threw up, it was an extra $5.
Oh, I'd charge more for that, I'll tell you, pal.
When I went back down to the jungles, I just started figuring it out. I had some friends who were missionary pilots who gave me tips and things, but I had an old ragged out Cessna 172, and I thought we'd use it to go in and get supplies in the edge of the jungles. In 14 months, I made 2,300 flights, most of them an average of 8 minutes, which is 16 hours on the trail. So. It really, when the Waurani, when these people I was living with found out that there was an airplane living in their territory, some people would walk days just to verify that there really was a plane in their territory, so if they called it, it could come and bring them help. And you know, I've always loved flying, but I agree, I've never really enjoyed just boring holes in the sky. But when I'd get a call like one I got one day from a Well, somebody actually outside the jungles when I was getting supplies said that they'd heard by radio that there was a young mother had delivered a baby and she was bleeding, and they were afraid she was going to die, and it was late in the afternoon, too late to fly in. And so I went in and I unloaded supplies and asked the Waurani, what do you think? Should I go? And they said, you know, maybe this isn't true. Maybe they're saying Ononki. Maybe they're saying this for no reason. But then my tribal grandmother said, but maybe... this is true. So I flew up, and this young mother had delivered the baby, but the placenta wouldn't deliver, and she had been laying in her hammock bleeding to death for 24 hours. And in that warm, humid environment, I could already smell the decay. Her young husband standing there, the whole tribe in the house with them, and nobody knew what to do. And I had about 15 minutes interpreting for the Waurani women who had asked a doctor, you know, when we bleed in childbirth, what do we do? And I was just interpreting, but I remembered this female gynecologist had said something about doing abdominal massage and breast massage to get the woman lactating, and then described a DNC. And so I was there with this young mother, and so I got some of the women massaging her breast, and I began massaging her abdomen while gently pulling on the umbilical cord, and the placenta delivered and just covered me in blood. And my wife, who's here, is a nurse. I usually would call her on the radio and she'd tell me what not to do, and then I just sort of figured it out from there. But I flew home that night after the placenta delivered, and the next day I was going to fly back early in the morning, but it was terrible weather. So the following morning, I got there first thing, and the first person to meet me at the airstrip was that young mother who was not only dying in childbirth, but there were no other nursing mothers, so the baby would have died too. And she was down at the airstrip. When she heard the plane coming, she came down the airstrip with her little baby and then told me to come and eat wild pig meat with them. And on the way, the other Waorani kept saying, what is this baby's name, do you think? I didn't have any clue. And then finally somebody said, oh, don't you know anything? Calling it Baba, your very own name, that's how they're calling it. And I realized that I had gained standing in that village where the clan that I was related to was not part of that village. But they had given that baby my name because I had come. And although that made me feel really good, I started thinking, you know what? These people need a lot more than just somebody to come to help this mother. And a lot of the other help that they needed hope that went beyond just this temporal life. And I didn't, my command of the language, I'd been gone for so many years, wasn't good enough. And then I started realizing it shouldn't have been me, it should have been Tementa who was flying the plane. And that's when I committed myself and I said, I'm gonna figure out a way to put them in the pilot seat. If you've seen End of the Spear, Tementa was that little boy who was supposed to be buried alive when his father was speared, after his father's lie led to my father being speared. And today, Tementa is their first and only in history pilot.
Wow. Hey. You know, Steve, you would be forgiven if after all you went through and losing your father, if you just kept flying the Piper Cub around terrorizing people in the United States, you know? And I got to ask you.
I do it in an RV-10 now. Anybody want to ride?
I got to ask, you got to give us a little insight into, I'm sure it was a long process for you, but or was it, you know, to go down there and, it's hard to find a greater example of forgiveness.
Well, you know, coming from a world that, like this, which is really a very peaceful society by comparison. In the tribe, the Waorani had a 60% homicide rate. The oldest man in the tribe when my father was speared was in his early 30s. I don't have a friend in the tribe who's my age whose father died of natural causes. So when my father was speared by them,
it was all homicide?
60% homicide.
But of the friends, every one of those friends in the tribe?
Either their father's living or was speared by other people in the tribe or killed by oil company people coming in. So it made me more one of them. It really made me part of the club that my father had been speared to death too. But you know, when I first went in to live with them, a couple of years after my dad was speared, my aunt and one of the other widows went in to live with these people. And then my aunt talked to my mother. You know, women go through these...
Time out.
My aunt must have asked my mom at one of those special times, and my mom said yes, so I got to go in and live with my aunt. And people say, weren't you afraid? But, you know, my dad and his friends had guns, and they could have defended themselves. The fact that all five of them were speared, I knew, and my mom told me that they had decided beforehand that they would shoot their guns into the air if they needed, but that they would rather die than kill those people. And then my aunt went in, and this other widow went in at the risk of their lives. And you know, I saw that every night when we'd get together for family devotions and my mom would pray, she would pray for those people who had just brutally killed my dad. And I knew that that wasn't normal. But my dad thought these people were worth the risk. My mom kept praying for them and my aunt risked their lives. By the time I met them, I knew these had to be the most special people in the whole world and I couldn't wait to meet them.
Well, really? What was that meeting like though?
Well, I was dressed and their native costume consisted of a string which the men always wore around the waist. Sometimes the women, just to be higher class, they'd wear them around their knee. And they wore earplugs and people asked me all the time, why did they wear earplugs and feather headdresses? If all you were wearing is a string, wouldn't you want something to distract people's attention? So I got out of the plane and I was completely dressed and the people just looked at me and, you know, I had hair on my arms, which they didn't have, and my my skin was really light, and that scared them. And I had these things growing out of my face that they hadn't seen before. And I was completely covered, and I was fairly tall but skinny, and they couldn't tell what gender I was. So finally they send an old grandmother over, because grandmothers aren't worth that much unless you're my wife. We have 14 grandchildren, so that's special. But she came over and she kind of patted me down, and she still couldn't tell. So finally she grabbed my pants. I had these elastic waisted pants. She pulled them out and started giving everybody a running commentary. That's embarrassing enough, but then everybody started to laugh. They didn't know what I was. That was my first meeting with them. But you know, within just a few days, Minkai, one of the men, the man who actually finished killing my dad, took me into his house and started treating me like a son. And that really was the act of forgiveness, because he knew in his culture that it was not only my right, but it was my duty when I grew up to kill him or members of his family to avenge my father's death. And yet he took me in and taught me the skills that I needed out there in the jungles so I could have avenged my dad's killing.
That's quite a lesson to that. Do you think that's changed that tribe in a significant and profound way?
When they found out that Wang Ungi, the creator, did not see it well that people should hate and live in fear and kill each other, the killing almost all stopped. Now, that was the good part. The bad part of the story was that they didn't have anything to replace it with. Extremely egalitarian, so they had no rules. The idea of one adult telling another adult what to do is not only a foreign idea, but it's a violation of that person's autonomy. That's a killing offense, and that's still that way today. We have no law. If you don't like your neighbor, you can kill him, but then his family's supposed to come back and kill you. So no taxes, no permits, no. It's kind of nice, except for the neighbors. You want to stay friendly with the neighbors.
No FAA either, huh? Gracia, channel Martin here for a little bit. What would he say about flying and helping people in the Philippines?
I kind of figure Martin was kind of born to do that. His parents were tribal missionaries. He grew up in the Philippines, away at a boarding school in Manila, Faith Academy. And to get home to their tribal village from Manila, he would also go on a bus and then fly in a small missionary airplane into the village where his parents lived and worked. So he grew up loving missionary aviation, loving pilots. And when he came back to the States after he graduated from high school, he learned to fly, got his AMP, because that was a requirement for a new tribe's mission, and headed back to the field. And I just felt like he got to do what he was meant to do. And I love hearing Steve's stories. Steve has been very kind to my children, who also lost their father in the jungle. And on several occasions, he's met with my kids and just encouraged them to, I think what you've told them is, the way you live your life is what will validate what your dad died for. And to let God write their story, because if God writes your story, it's going to be a lot better than if you wrote the story. And just seeing all the reconciliation that happened with Steve's story, I think has been really encouraging to us. And well, this wasn't part of the question, but we've seen the same thing. I have found like 28 of the guys who held us hostage in the jungle. They're in Manila for the rest of their lives in jail. And through a missionary couple that's working in that jail, I've been able to reestablish relationships with those guys, and I'm starting to get letters from them. And we're able to get the scriptures in their own dialects, which they're so keen on having. They're studying the scriptures. Three of them have come to know the Lord. And I don't know. I think if you ask Martin today, would you do it again? I don't know what he would say, but isn't it good that the story has a good ending? God didn't have to do that for us. Martin could have died, and that was the end of it, and we just kind of went on living, and, you know, he could have been good to us, but he's given us this awesome end to the story, and the story's not even over. It's just been good. When God writes a story, he writes a good story.